to make an announcement.
Okay.
Yeah, let me go turn you up over yeah. here.
Yeah, it's telling me from the other side. Sorry to make you handle this.
Okay, next up we have Michael Beal. I'm sure a lot of you know. He's a professor of radio TV at Morehead State University, former president of ARSC, and a private collector. And he'll be speaking today about the development of instantaneous recording and the recording studio industry.
Completely wired for sound here. Before we get too far with Natalia, I want to give a couple of gifts. As many of you know, I've been corresponding and dealing with some of the Russian archives and giving presents. Now, all of you know, or many of you know, that I have for many years theorized that there is one record that shows up in every junk pile, right? What is that record, class? Near You and Red Rose by Francis Craig on Bullitt. Now, the thing is, yesterday I spent about 2 hours going through almost every 78 at Great Escape, and for some reason I couldn't find it. But I did find a Bullitt record. This is Flamin' Mamie by Ray Pearl and his orchestra. It is proof that there was more than one record that came out on Bullitt. And I want to present this to you for another reason, that this was, as we found out the last time we were here in Nashville, the first or one of the first record labels located here in Nashville. Now, this is a rotten copy. It's been melted a little bit. But the label looks fine. So I want to give you a copy of this and also a copy of the soundtrack from Letter to Brezhnev. Now on with the business at hand here. In the past installments of this history of the record industry and its relationship with the broadcasting industry, almost everything I discussed concerned making standard records, recording on wax, electroplating to get a master, and then pressing multiple copies on shellac. This was an expensive process, and while it was occasionally used for personal recordings and broadcast recordings, the heritage of our broadcasting industry would not exist if it had not been the development of an easy, inexpensive, and quality method of making one-of-a-kind recordings. This, of course, was the instantaneous recording, and more specifically, the lacquer-coated aluminum disc, also often incorrectly called acetates. That occurred in around 1934. But prior to that development, there were other methods of instantaneous recording that are so interesting that the telling of their story will take up all of my time today. We'll save the lacquer disc story for next year. First of all, let me present a definition of the term instantaneous recording. This means the recording exists in completed form the instant it is made, one that can be played back immediately without any further processing. The British use a similar term, direct recording. I dislike this one for one reason. It does imply the specific item recorded is the item that it itself is played back. But the phrase does not inherently disallow the notion of a required processing step. No, don't take it off. Let me give an example. When Edison developed his tinfoil phonograph and the wax cylinder which followed is developed by Bell, Tainter, and Edison, the tinfoil or wax recordings were played back directly, but were also available instantly. On the other hand, when Emil Berliner, working on ideas put forth by Charles Crowe, came up with the idea of the acid-etched zinc disc, it required processing. The actual zinc disc that was on the recording machine could be played, but first a groove would have to be etched by the acid because the recording had only really been made in the wax coating. Thus, it could be considered to be a direct recording because it's the same piece of zinc that's on the turntable, but not an instantaneous recording. Now, this was just the start of the problem because of the greater popularity of disc recording. Cylinder machines were all capable of making records. Inexpensive attachments were available for later models when they no longer came equipped with recording heads as standard equipment. But the regular disc phonograph was never designed to be adaptable as a recording machine. So opportunities for making recordings were reduced greatly when the disc became more common than the cylinder. Reduced, but not impossible. And I'll even demonstrate. In January 1897, Eldridge R. Johnson, 100 years ago now, Eldridge R. Johnson reported that he realized that if he shouted into a horn when a zinc disc with blank grooves was being traced by the needle, a faint sound would be recorded. He never patented it or did anything about it. But in April 1921, Victor H. Emerson applied for a patent and received it. Number 1444960 on February 13th, 1923. Ironically, this became one of the two basic patents on instantaneous recording, although it has no relationship to most of the forms that we know. The basis for this patent is a broad, wide pre-groove. And in the soft zinc disc, when placed on a normal acoustical phonograph, the needle will vibrate when someone shouts into the horn. The needle will dig into or indent one or the other of the sides of the groove wall and can allow for a faint recording to be heard a couple of times. As you can see, I happen to have here an acoustical phonograph, a Victrola the Ninth. And here is one of the zinc pre-grooved discs. This was marketed, you can put this on now, in the 20s under several such names as Echo Disc, Co-Disc, Brilliant, Repeat a Voice, Sing a Song, and a few other clever names. Well, not to steal any thunder from the acoustical recording session with the Fisk Singers later in this conference, because this recording certainly will not be thunderous, I'm about to stage an acoustical recording session of my own. For this, I am going to use Thomas A. Edison's little piece of practical poetry, although I will update it to the realities of the year 1997. Let's see if we get this going here. Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was slightly gray. It didn't have a father, just some borrowed DNA. Now let's see if it works. Isn't that amazing technology? Now, it certainly does not provide a recording worthy of writing home about, nor is it worthy of sending home either. This system was only a novelty and a short-lived one at that, except for the patent number. There were other attempts at allowing for home disc recording. Actually, you can go through a couple of the other ones here. These are the Echo and Repeat a Voice sleeves, and this was the Brilliant and the Recordo. There were some other attempts for home disc recording. Go to the next one. The Eureka was a system marketed in England in 1910 by Edison Bell, which recorded vertically on a half-inch thick wax tablet. They could be replayed on a special reproducing head erased by using a special liquid solvent, or could be processed into a regular shellac pressing by the Edison Bell factory. This description sounds similar to the Pathé Roniophone, which was used as a dictating machine in competition to things like the Ediphone and Dictaphone. In 1914, an Englishman residing in France, Ernest Albert Ivatz, applied for a patent for recording on a special phonic disc consisting of a core of cardboard, paper, or analogous material covered on its two faces with a layer of wax or suitable composition for receiving the record. The U.S. patent 1269607 was granted on June 18, 1918, and assigned to Pathé, which used it as the basis for the Pathé Voice Writer or the Pathé Post. The wax-coated disc was only a small part of the system. More important was Ivatz's use of a groove tracker disc. And this is the tracker arm, and there's one on this side also, to move the arm across the record, this extra tracker disc. The recording disc, I didn't get a color copy of this one. This is the recording disc, and the outside is the blank grooved tracker disc. Now, a further development came with the use of a different type of disc on the Pathé Voice Writer, and this was the subject of Henry Wadsworth's patent 421045, applied for on March 13, 1918, and received on June 27, 1922. It's the other patent number often seen on blanks used in the early to mid-1930s. Wadsworth's patent described a groove which was embossed on a blank aluminum disc by a very heavy recording head using a blunt jeweled stylus. On the next picture, this is another European machine which allowed language students to record on discs. Several other acoustical systems were marketed. On the next picture, one was the Fay, which was introduced in Britain as late as 1932, which used a feed screw mechanism driven by a turntable and a horn and recorder that could be attached to a regular tone arm. This seems to be at least similar to the device advertised in co-eds and college humor magazines as late as 1940. It used a horn recorder, a blank disc, and a tracking device. On the next picture, another system seems similar to a Vetz coated disc called the Talkback Phonograph Recording Disc. It's an 8-inch pre-grooved wax coated on cardboard disc I saw in the Library of Congress, and it appears to use also a small horn and recorder. From what I remember of the fragility of these discs, I don't see how they could be played back on any phonograph, at least not too many times. I have no date on this, but it does post-date the introduction of radio. In all of these cases, it would be difficult to record a radio program on one of these moving horns following along the tone arm. None of these systems as they stood had any potential to be used professionally or to make a recording of any quality, but the groundwork had been laid. By the way, the cylinder had not been ignored either. On the next picture is Charles Apgar, who made the first known sound recordings of a radio transmission on October 28, 1913, of the Morse code bulletins transmitted by the New York Herald. He had merely mounted a headphone on a cylinder dictating recording head. He became famous 2 years later in 1915 when his recordings of the German-run station WSY Sayville, Long Island, proved that it was sending out messages which violated the U.S.'s neutrality. The director of the station, Dr. Carl Georg Franck, provided some humor by insisting, "The statement that Mr. Apgar can record messages sent out by wireless on a phonographic cylinder is hardly worth discussing. That is physically impossible. I have never heard of it being done. If Mr. Apgar has accomplished it, he should get his idea patented and perhaps we will buy it." This was especially humorous because the station was using a magnetic wire recorder, the telegraphophone, to send speeded up Morse messages to be recorded and slowed down by a telegraphophone on the receiving end. Now, I forgot to give you this tape. Yeah. I'm only playing two things. You know that I hate cassettes. So I'll put it on a regular cassette. And this is a recording of a 1934 broadcast where he repeats the quote from Frank. "The quality of the dubbing of the original broadcast recording is so bad that I quoted that letter that he quotes again to help you understand the tape." Now, following it, you'll hear a portion of one of his 1913 recordings.
"Yes, indeed. The general manager of the Sayville station, Carl G. Frank, said when he was informed of my work, the statement that Mr. Apgar can record messages sent out by wireless on a phonographic cylinder is hardly worth discussing. That is perfectly impossible. I never heard it being done."
"Well, you fooled him. Well, I can understand him saying that in 1915. But how long have you been making these recordings, Mr. Apgar?"
"Well, I have here a letter from the Atlantic Communications Company, which operated the Sayville station, signed by Mr. Bernard, Operation Manager. He asked me to send in to him one or two of my phonographic records made of their station. And on February 9th, 1913, for many years before Frank said it was possible. I delivered personally to Mr. Gourmet two phonographic records of messages sent out by the Shaver station dated November 3rd, 1913 and November 4th, 1913. So you see, I have been making these records about 2 years, almost 2 years, before Frank said it was impossible.
Here's the cylinder. He did a better job than the guy at WOR, apparently. Or at least the better than, this is from Audio Magazine. They could have done a lot better, and I didn't have access to my equalizer when I dubbed it onto the cassette. That's why I don't use cassettes, right? Additionally, another article in the November 1950 Electrical Experimenter further discussed the recording of the sound of radio transmissions on magnetic discs of either metal or one coated with magnetic powder. By the late 1920s, the Blattner phone and the improved Marconi Steely steel tape recorder was being used by some broadcasters. And of course, in the mid-1930s, the AEG magnetophone was developed and used by the German broadcasters from the late 30s. But magnetic recording is a topic for another time. After APCAR, the wax machine continued to find some limited use. For example, this is the most frustrating item in my collection. It was given to me by an old collector in Texas I visited with Steve Sisler about 20 years ago. It's a box for a cylinder sent to station WGY Schenectady as a reception report sometime in the 1920s by an Edison dealer in Cape Town. There's no further location mentioned. I've been unable to locate another Cape Town other than the one in South Africa. If that is true, this was a remarkable feat in radio reception, but possible in the uncrowded bands of the early 20s. When I asked that collector if there had been a cylinder with it, he said that there might have been, but if there wasn't much to hear on it, he would have shaved it and reused it for recording. The ability to reuse those cylinders was an attractive feature that allowed some announcers to use it for rehearsing. Additionally, in this next picture, this 1932 item shows a cylinder dictating machine being used by KOIL to record a remote sports play-by-play by the phone for transcribing into a script for a delayed studio rebroadcast. In the late 1920s, the editor of Radio Broadcast Magazine, Edgar H. Felix, used a cylinder dictating machine to make recordings of the Cooley Ray photo facsimile picture for repeated reprintings. But the cylinder machine had been rejected by the public at large, and the various tape machines were large, cumbersome, and expensive. What was needed was a disc recording system that was inexpensive and allowed for playback on normal phonographs. At the beginning of the 1930s, several emerged. The introduction of electrical reproducing machines, ironically, made some of those systems possible. Because these phonographs were often part of a radio-phono combination, the use of these machines for recording radio programs was a natural. While some of these systems were devised as amateur or at least semi-professional, you'll see some fully professional machines were made that used the same basic recording techniques or materials. All of these methods had precedence in the earlier systems I've described, but the difference was the use of electronics. Rumors had been heard of the use of some of these systems as far back as 1927, and in 1929, Columbia University was using some sort of system to make some fairly acceptable recordings of the poet Vachel Lindsay. But the introduction of acceptable recording devices seemed to start in 1930. You can go to the next one. I have not been able to accurately date the introduction of the speakerphone phonograph or aluminum discs and the Remsen disc, and I've got the discs here somewhere, but they look sort of like these. They may have come earlier in the year, but in the October issue of the Trade Press Radio Retailing, two machines were announced. One was the Sentinel, and that's pictured down here, which could record on these aluminum discs, and the other was the RCA Radiola 86 down here. And there also is another picture of it up on the top corner. So you can see it was not, a major announcement. It was with all these other announcements as well. And this recorded on a special pre-grooved plastic disc. The groove on the Victor home recording disc was a novel development. Unlike the pre-groove on Victor Emerson's zinc disc, which was wide and shallow, the groove on the Victor disc was narrow. The resulting and a special wide, blunt needle was used to record. What would happen is it would widen the groove, and the resulting recording was up high in the groove, up on the shoulders of the land. It had to be played back with that same size blunt needle. If it was played back with a regular needle, the needle would drop deeper in the groove and miss the modulations that were up on the shoulders. The Victor disc was made possible by the two-way properties of electrical transducers, especially the magnetic pickup heads that were then in use. If placed in the output circuit of the amplifier in place of the loudspeaker, the needle in the pickup would vibrate. Thus, all that was needed to make a Radiola 86 a recording machine was a selector switch to place the pickup in the output, a microphone, and an input selector to switch to allow between the radio or the microphone, and of course, the special blunt needles. No feed screw mechanism was required. The equivalent models in the new General Electric and Westinghouse lines were similarly equipped. And within months, many of the aftermarket pickup manufacturers like Pascent modified the connections to their arms to allow for recording on the RCA disc. RCA made it clear to their dealers that the sound quality of the recordings made on these pre-grooved discs was not going to be as good as the commercial Victor records that their customers were accustomed to. They even produced a shellac recording for their salesman called How to Sell Victor Home Recording.
Please see that all the salespeople in your store hear and study this record. Will you call them together right now, please? The purpose of this special Victor record is to help you sell home recording as a feature of the new Victor instrument. There is a right way and a wrong way to sell home recording. Don't allow yourself or your customer to expect too much of home recording. The natural attitude will be to expect records as good as standard Victor recordings, because people have been taught by Victor advertising to think of quality when they think of Victor. Explain that home recordings made by amateurs under haphazard conditions and with very simple equipment can hardly be compared with Victor records made by the best talent in the world in laboratories costing hundreds of thousands of dollars with recording experts and costly equipment. Family gatherings and similar occasions all cry out for recording. Specially amusing bits from favorite radio programs offer another opportunity for home recording. Now, turn the record over and get some more ideas. Now, of course, the way to sell any Victor instrument is by demonstration. To demonstrate home recording, you must have ready right on the tip of your tongue some reasonably interesting remarks. Unless you are prepared, you will be awkward and tongue-tied when you pick up that microphone in front of a stranger. I've tried it, and I was as dumb as a wooden Indian. So be prepared. When you get to the point of actual demonstration, you will naturally ask the customer to make a record. The chances are 10 to 1 that he will refuse at first and say, no, you make one. Here's a suggestion for your demonstration record. This is one of the first Victor home recording records made in Name Your Town. It is being played on the Victor Radio Electrola RE57, which combines the world's finest radio with its five circuits, screen grid radiotrons, and micro-synchronous tuning with the new Electrola, the instrument that brings records to life and life to records. I am presenting this record to Name Your Prospect as a souvenir of his or her introduction to the new 1931 Victor radio. This is Mr. John Adams of Adams Music Store, 581 Main Street. Memorize this little talk so that you can recite it without hesitation. Remember that the customer will take it home and play it for his friends. thus giving you a free and valuable advertisement. Remind him that the record can be played on the orthophonic Victrola as well as the Electrola, provided the special needle for home recorded records is used. Then, get the customer to make a record on the reverse side of the recording blank. We have supplied you with a card on which a number of suggested talks for the customer are printed. In recording radio, select the quietest station within range, remembering that station noises and static, as well as the music, will be recorded. Sell home recording hard, but don't oversell it. As far as it goes, it is a masterpiece, but it isn't the heart of the instrument. It's an extra dividend Victor is paying to those who buy 1931 Victor radio.
Now, to sort of emphasize that fact there, the last few seconds of that record trail off into almost nothing. That is the problem of the normal shellac record. They did a lousy job of recording professionally in their studio with hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Now, despite the lack of broadcast quality sound, with a little bit of care accorded to selecting the recording levels, an acceptable recording could be made. Perhaps the most important customer to use this system was the Federal Radio Commission. In late 1931, they had RCA develop a setup to allow them to make recordings of broadcasts that were the subject of license revocation litigation. For many years, there were no signs of any of this type of recordings in the sound recording division of the National Archives where they belonged. I gave Les Waffen a copy of this article about 25 years ago, and about 10 years ago, about 180 discs were discovered. Because their 6 and 10 inch size allowed them to be placed in the file folder along with the paper records of the court cases, that's where the discs had been filed. The recordings were made in several different FRC field offices between 1932 and 34 and provide a fascinating picture of some of the worst excesses of early broadcasters. The first version of the Victor home recording discs were available at 6 inches in diameter with white labels. They were individually sleeved in these green plastic green illustrated sleeves and sold in packs of three in a mailing envelope with the special needle. These discs were actually made of thin celluloid with a cardboard center core. Unless the seam at the rim of the disc is split, this lamination is not immediately noticeable. In 1931, they released 10 and then 12-inch versions with orange labels, which were made of solid vinyl. All of these discs I've seen remain in good condition without any signs of the wax leaching that is very common with Victrolac pressings of long playing program transcriptions. But Graham Newton in Canada has seen some Canadian pressings that do exhibit some of this leaching. Although the system soon became obsolete, they continued to make the discs for more than a decade. On April 23, 1935, the company name was changed to RCA Manufacturing Company. And on April 1st, 1942, the Nipper logo was removed from the label. Finally, on August 2nd, 1944, the label printing plates and the remaining stock of labels were destroyed. At the same time as the RCA systems had been announced in September 1930, as I mentioned, the Sentinel Chromatrola was introduced. It embossed a groove on plain, bare aluminum. Now, within a month, the Presto Corporation of America, founded by Morris Gruber and George Saliba, introduced an ingenious kit that allowed for the embossing of aluminum discs on almost any existing phonograph. A feed screw was connected to the center part of the turntable, and a 3-pound recording head was placed on the feed screw. There was a leather-lined groove at the bottom of the head, which gripped the threads with a cushion grip and moved the head along the recording blank. The front heavy balance of the head placed the proper amount of weight on the embossing stylus. A self-contained portable unit, you can see here that head sitting on the feed screw there. Go to the next one also. A self-contained portable unit was available by the spring of 1931. That's the recording mode, the playback mode. Next. And they also, there's the portable unit again, April 31. Next. There also was a console unit, next, and some heavy-duty units were also made in 1931. See, here's using almost the same head, but there's a handle in front of it. Within the same year, other companies had marketed machines. This is a Caliphone, which is part of a public address system set up. Okay, and the aforementioned speakerphone. Oh, that's another Caliphone and built onto the top of a radio phone. Oh, and now comes, okay. In November, radio retailing presented an editorial about home recording being a good opportunity for the businessmen, for the radio salespeople. In December 1930, a cover article appeared in Radio Craft magazine. Isn't that great? Yeah, a color transparency. And the editor, Hugh Gernsback, added a laudatory editorial stating, "From now on, there is to be added to radio reception the practice of home recording. This in time may prove of formidable proportions. Let us hope that the home recording idea will take root, for it's notorious and can be made to be a big adjunct to radio." Speakerphone's approach was different from most. Rather than emphasize the sale of their machines to a depression-weary retail customer, they set up recording studios in several major cities and encouraged the radio, record, and appliance dealers to do likewise. Individuals were encouraged to come in and make a snapshot of their voice and perform musical selections or make a record to mail to loved ones. Stern Brothers, a major Midtown Manhattan store, advertised early in the Christmas season of 1930 that for 75 cents you could make a double-faced speakerphone record to send abroad for Christmas. "Send your friend wintering at the Côte d'Azur this personalized greeting. You could send nothing that would be more welcome than a record of your own voice wishing him a Merry Christmas from across the Atlantic." The speakerphone machines were not very elaborate. They were almost like home machines. But the recording studio idea spread. The aluminum discs were easy to record and with the proper equipment could present an acceptable sound. In early 1931, trade press articles suggested that advertisers and performers could check the performance of their programs and advertisements. Universal Radio Productions in Chicago announced just such a service in April 1931. By 1934, they were a full-service recording studio, even dealing in making masters for processing for syndication. But on November 21st, 1931, they staged a publicity stunt by recording the entire 2.5-hour broadcast of the Southern California Notre Dame football game, said to be the longest radio recording that had ever been made. In 1932, they broke a speed record by providing the cast of Fu Manchu a recording of the broadcast to listen to less than an hour after its completion. Another Chicago concern, the Green Recording Studio, advertised as early as June 1931 a free sample recording of your program and mentioned that Quaker Oats, Packard Autos, and Allied Paint already were large users of Green Check recordings. Some of you might recognize Ann Allen in that picture, and George Blacker, Roy Evans, Mort Zavada, and Carl Canzioria. It just is from the front of a record research magazine, and this is John Leifert's disc from the Green Recording Studio that he loaned me one time. Another Chicago studio, Doolittle and Faulkner, opened in December 1931. May 1932 saw the opening of Burt Gottschalk's Electrovoice Studio in Los Angeles, which was still operating in the 1980s when I visited it. Sometime in 1931 was the opening of a major studio in New York that was known at various times as the Recordograph, Broadcast Producers of New York, and Broadcast Transcriptions. And I've got about two more to go through there. National Recording Studios was opened in Washington's National Press Building in early 1932 and hoped to interest members of Congress who might want to send discs to local broadcasting stations. This is another one here advertising broadcasting service. We can leave that for now. It's not generally known what machines some of these studios used. Most intriguing, let me mention this one. Most intriguing was of the studios that recorded on bare aluminum was Audioscriptions, which was run in New York by Ezekiel Rabinowitz. In addition to their regular studio operations, they ran a clippings bureau of the air and maintained a huge library of voices which were available for purchase. They recorded programs and then offered copies to the participants. The originals were maintained, and by the end of the 1930s, they claimed to have a library of 100,000 voices, with 75 to 100 being added daily. They continued to use aluminum because it could be preserved forever. But what happened to this library? Just think of it. Here's a company which, during the aluminum-starved war, had perhaps hundreds of thousands of aluminum discs. Did they go to the metal drives? All I know is this. They issued a shellac pressing of excerpts of VE and VJ Day speeches in 1945. But boy, would that collection be a find. Notably absent is any indication that radio stations themselves installed recording equipment. I know that the networks didn't until much later. The Gates Broadcast Equipment Company had this simple recording turntable in their catalog, which used the RCA pre-groove discs, but it probably wasn't a big seller. The Lord and Thomas Advertising Agency installed some RCA equipment in mid-1932, but most of the aircheck recordings of the early 30s were recorded either by an amateur or independent studio, such as the ones we named. I should mention that some performers were noted for making recordings for critiquing and preserving their programs in the early 30s, such as Rudy Valley, George Burns, Jack Benny, Fred Allen, and Andre Castellanets. It's not generally known what machines most of these studios used. They could have been the same machines available for home use, or this unnamed unit. But the Universal Microphone Company of Inglewood, this next one, offered what is perhaps the ugliest recording machine ever manufactured. It had a large, heavy turntable with an overly long feed screw arm, and both of them were belt-driven by a motor that was on a separate chassis. Having that motor on a separate chassis and this absorbent belt cut down on vibrations, and it was truly a professional machine. They also made a simpler device which utilized a feed screw which would drive the recording arm from an extension on the front. See the arm? Yeah, well, here's the arm, and this is where the feed screw would attach. They continued to champion the use of bare aluminum discs through the end of the 1930s, claiming that the preservation qualities of the coated disc was unproven, and they may have been right. Recordings on bare aluminum had one major drawback. Because of the heavy weight of the playback heads of the day, they had to be played back with fiber or bamboo needles. This reduced the high frequencies of the sound and necessitated a playing time of no more than 5 minutes, because that was as long as a fiber needle could remain sharp enough. In the mid-1930s, the Fairchild Aerial Camera Company developed a fiber needle that was impregnated with a plastic that allowed a 15-minute playing time. And this is a rare sample from Mike Stosich of a 16-inch aluminum blank. And you see it's a Fairchild. And this is one of their normal size discs with a paste-on paper label. But this also is an aluminum. When recording on bare aluminum, it was recommended to lightly lubricate the disc with a slight amount of wax or oil before recording. This would fill the pores of the metal and reduce the drag and friction on the stylus, but no processing after recording was required. Most of the aluminum discs I have seen are bright and shiny. Only occasionally are there spots of corrosion. If they had not been played much, they can provide an excellent recording with only a slight amount of surface noise and a metallic whirring sound. Modern lightweight equipment can get the high frequencies that the fiber stylus could not. But care must be taken to make sure that the stylus is really in the groove, because sometimes the stylus can ride on the land in between the groove and lightly emboss its own little groove into that top surface. So always give a little push to make sure it's in the groove. This is the cutting needle, or actually the embossing needle. You see that it is bent at an angle, and this would be the type of recording or a reproducing needle. A trailing needle is what that was called, but you see the extra angle of bent. On some of the heads which were used later for both coated and uncoated discs, there would be an extra weight that would be placed on the head when you embossed, and you would take that extra weight off when you were cutting into plastic, either supported or unsupported. Now, during the early 1930s, There were numerous experiments with other materials, namely plastics like celluloid and gelatin. Now, embossed grooves could relax and tend to fill up, something that might have happened with some of the RCA pre-grooved discs. When these materials are cut with a sharp stylus, they don't always cut cleanly and quietly. Unsupported floppy plastic sheets can also deform and not lay flat. Gelatin was used for only a very short time, since it had to be lubricated with Vaseline before cutting to maintain the sharpness of the steel needles, and after cutting also to smooth out the sides of the grooves. It dried out easily, was prone to crack, and could also be damaged by water. It was water soluble. Celluloid turned out to be a lot better. The recordings could be quite good, and in June 1931, George Sleeber wrote that both nitrate and acetate celluloid was available, and that the nitrate film, preferably clear and not colored, had better cutting properties. Pigments introduced resistance to the stylus, he said. Later on, his opinions changed as he had a chance to experiment while developing the lacquer-coated disc. There were some professional studios that used celluloid instead of aluminum, and this recording is on flexible blue-colored celluloid and was in fine shape when I photographed it at Jerry Valburn's about 25 years ago. Likewise was the recording the same company made at their laboratories in my hometown of Teaneck, New Jersey, of the four-hour inaugural broadcast of Ed Wynn's short-lived amalgamated broadcasting system in September 1933. The National Archives borrowed it from the Ed Wynn estate about 20 years ago. But similar recordings like the 1934 George Gershwin Fineman programs, I don't know what studio recorded those, had deteriorated by 1948 and had to be dubbed onto lacquers. And there are some skips from that bumpy recording that were re-recorded onto the dub, and those lacquers have deteriorated. Those are at LC. Embossing unsupported plastics also re-emerged later for dictating machine use, such as, where are they? There's one of them. The Gray autograph with a serrated center hole. The Soundscriber, which used a square center hole. And the Edison Diamond Disc Voice Rider, which used a 45 RPM size hole in the 1950s. During the late 1930s, the Dictaphone Company was experimenting on embossing. All these are embossed, not cut, by the way. But in the late 30s, the Dictaphone Company was experimenting on embossing on celluloid discs and also on floppy cylinders that would be placed onto a wax cylinder. Dictaphone. Now this, of course, evolved into the Dictabelt, which of course is nothing but a floppy cylinder. Likewise, cutting in a groove on unsupported plastic had an interesting history in Eastern Europe. When recording materials were in short supply, some enterprising recordists discovered that X-ray sheet film had excellent recording properties. Turn him so he's standing up there. Some broadcasts of Béla Bartók were recorded on X-ray film in Budapest, Hungary around 1940 as World War II began. And they've been issued on Hungaroton. During the Cold War years in the 1950s, an underground industry began in Russia, recording jazz and rock recordings from the Voice of America and other sources on X-ray film. Called Jazz on the Bones and later Rock on the Bones, the collection of them that I was privileged to see in Moscow seemed to be highly professionally recorded, with a proper-sized spindle hole and a perfectly round outer edge. This one I obtained at the Izmailova Flea Market in Moscow. The recording on it is Les Paul and Mary Ford's 1953 recording of Johnny is the Boy for Me. Now, the Soviet X-ray film used is much thinner than the film used here and is about the same thickness as ordinary snapshot film. And it's starting to split at the seam, split at some of the grooves. So better take it off the heat there. When I made an overhead transparency of it, I got the bright idea, well, maybe I could cut a groove on the transparency film, and I tried here, but it's a lousy material that the thread doesn't even separate from the plastic. I got about 3 minutes, okay? I'll try some X-ray film and report back next year. Now, speaking of experiments, although the Presto Company had gone bankrupt in 1932, George Saliba and Morris Gruber started to experiment on a better idea, that of coating plastic onto the aluminum and cutting a groove into the supported, nope, that's the wrong one. That's the one. That was cheating there. They worked from 1932, and finally in October 1934, the cellulose nitrate lacquer-coated aluminum disc was introduced as the Presto disc. Commonly and incorrectly called acetate, this disc revolutionized the recording industry. It provided a recording disc that was not much more difficult to use than the aluminum, but allowed for recordings that were quieter than commercially released shellac records, were able to be played back on normal phonographs with regular steel needles, and could also be used to replace wax for electroplating processing to make multiple pressings. Within 2 years, radio stations began to purchase recording equipment, and within 5 years, almost every station the networks had begun to use their own recording equipment, and home recording became even more popular. And the development of that disc will come next time. But I've got a surprise here. The piece de resistance. Now, earlier I demonstrated perhaps the most primitive acoustical recording session. Now I want to demonstrate perhaps the newest development in recorded sound. No, it's not the DVD, the digital versatile disc. What I want to demonstrate is something that is quite versatile, but not yet on the market. It is the Columbia Double Disc CD. You will note that I have here in my hand a Columbia compact disc. I will now ask that a couple of seconds of this Columbia compact disc be played so that you see that it is a real compact disc. Yes, thank you. May I have the disc, please? Now comes the surprise. You see, I have here a Victrola Model VVIX acoustical Victor talking machine. Da-da. Spindle hole's not the right size.
Columbia Record affords the best possible evidence of the quality of Columbia recording. It demonstrates the faithfulness of our reproduction of the singing voice, and it is typical of the quality of every record in the entire Columbia list. A point to remember, Columbia double disc records may be played on either Columbia or Victor machines, and they will unfailingly outwear any other record.
Perfect sound forever. Thank you.
Okay, we've run through our Thanks, Mike. We've run through our question time for this session, so we need to break for lunch.
I'll be here for the next 3 days.
And we'll meet back here at 1:30.